Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here, hanging out with Henry. Yeah. Thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. We really appreciate you, and we hope you're doing all right this year as, you know, the best you can, as we're all sort of struggling here. But we are staying afloat, and we are getting through it together. Today, we are honored to have with us, he is the director of a brand new documentary called The Phenomenon. James Fox is with us. James, thanks so much for being on the show, man.
Pleasure to be here, guys. Sorry about the background here. It's just our whole house got tented. And so we put all of our stuff in our office, and our office is all clustered and overflowing.
Well, it's the cleanest office that we have ever seen because, as you can tell, nothing is clean around us whatsoever. We live in a world of clutter.
I'm sitting in a pool of farts, James.
I didn't. If I rotate the camera a little for you, just the right angle.
There's a naked man in the corner.
So just to prep the audience a little bit, today's episode will be very alien heavy, so I know we'll have a lot to talk about.
Mr. Fox, number one, massive fan of your documentaries over the year, which it's crazy to kind of walk into this because I didn't understand that you also made one of my favorite UFO documentaries in the world, which is I Know What I Saw.
Oh, I love that one.
And my wife and I, because we genuinely, you know, every day, almost every day, we have I Know What I Saw, because it's my favorite UFO documentary title, because it's the only one that really, truly encapsulates the feeling of the frustration of being inside of the UFO. ufological world.
You know where that title came from? I've never had titles for any of my movies, you know, until they come. You can't force a good title to come. And I've learned to be patient. And I was in the edit room with I Know What I Saw, and people kept saying to me, you know, what's the name going to be? And I'm like, I don't know. I have a working title, Beyond the Blue, but I don't like it. And I kept hearing this frustration from these witnesses, and they kept saying, look, you know, when they, especially with the Phoenix Lights case, the very infamous March 1997 UFO flyover of the state of Arizona.
Oh, I'm still bitter about Fife Symington's little sketch.
We just spoke about it this past Tuesday on our show Side Stories. Yeah, he's very upset.
I got Fife to come clean.
Really?
Yeah, you did.
I did. And I did it. It's funny, I'm getting kind of sidetracked here. Let me tell you how I named the film I Know What I Saw. People, witnesses, were so frustrated by those explanations, either with swamp gas or military flares or weather balloons or whatever it was. They were responding really angrily. And they kept saying, like, don't tell me what I saw. I know what I saw. And I kept hearing it in the edit room over and over and over. But it didn't dawn on me until one day, this woman's like, I'm so sick and tired of this. I know what I saw. And I went, ding.
There it is.
That's a great title.
I know what I saw.
It is a perfect, perfect title.
Oh, yeah. People told me at the time, because I did that event at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. with Leslie King. And it's basically a bunch of retired military men from seven countries. Granted, it was a global effort, talking about their personal experience during their official duties or their sightings, whatever it was. Right. And people were like, you can't make a movie on that. Like, I'm sorry, but that'll just put everyone to sleep. And I said, well, if Al Gore can make a film from a PowerPoint presentation, then by golly, I can make it, So.
And I have said this before, and I'll say it again. Global warming is the exact same as aliens. Big if true.
It is big, and they are both big and true. Your documentaries of all of them that I watch, anyone that comes down the pipe, because I like to see all the different, I love chicanery. I also love new proofs. You have an ability to get a hold of some really good old-fashioned real military men, really big people. Like, I know you probably can't talk about how you get these guys to talk on camera, but you get some legit sources.
It's pretty remarkable, you know. And I'll tell you the turning point in my career, and I kind of never looked back. To get your foot in the door with those military guys, it's all about trust, because there's really nothing for them to gain in coming forward and everything for them to lose. Right. And so a big moment for me was when I got a sit down interview with former Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon. And it was funny, actually. We were walking together doing a B-roll shot in his backyard in Florida. Excuse me. And he goes, I actually said, God, I'm so amazed. I'm standing here, you know, with you, sir. Why? And I'd written him and called him for 3 or 4 years prior to this moment. And I said, gosh, you know, if you don't mind me asking, how come you agreed to finally meet with me? And he gave the simplest, funniest answer. He's like, because I realized you wouldn't go away.
Dude, yes. That is it. The persistence of being a documentarian. No one can ever underestimate how much of a pain in the ass you have to be.
That was it, you know, and I realized. and then once I got him, I got Mercury astronaut Gordon Cooper, that whole landing case incident, Edwards Air Force Base. And then I did Out of the Blue. And then I did a second version of Out of the Blue. And I don't know if you guys have seen Out of the Blue or not.
Years ago.
Okay, yeah. So there was a first version that we sold to NBC Universal. That was in 2003. And when I sold it, I wasn't happy with the end result. I mean, you have a vision of how you want something to materialize.
Of course.
And it just wasn't that. But I had my editing partner and co-producer, this guy Boris Zuboff, in a fetal position on the ground. I'm not exaggerating. Literally crying in a ball. I was pushing him so hard. And his wife turned to me and she's like, you're fucking killing my husband. What is wrong with you? Stop it. Like this.
Oh, right? My goodness.
I'm not kidding you. I'm not exaggerating. So I was like, okay, I guess I have to like stop this film project for now. Anyway, the film sold to NBC Universal and off it went. And then 3 years later, I owned the movie again. And I went back at it and I spent another 2.5 years revising Out of the Blue and had a second version that was released. And then that wasn't good enough. And so I was back at it. And then I Know What I Saw was born. Right. And,
yes.
And then I was depressed when I finished I Know What I Saw. And it was really funny. Actually, my dad was my biggest skeptic initially when I said I was doing all these documentaries on UFOs. I mean, he's a mainstream journalist. He was paralyzed from the neck down most of my adult life.
Oh, wow.
He had multiple sclerosis. And so he was a journalist, and I would travel the world with him. We had met such notables as Stephen Hawking, theoretical physicist in England, and race car legend Dan Gurney. We just did a lot of cool stuff. We traveled down to Mexico City for the Grand Prix. And anyway, I was his legs, his secretary, his nurse, and his writing partner. We had a great relationship. But anyway, I was telling him I wanted to do this documentary on UFOs, and he was just over. He was like, you're wasting your life. There's nothing to it. It's a dead-end road.
Yep.
Right, and then
day.
Not only that,
I hear it every day.
He had people from my family, because my family's all over the world, and they were writing me letters going, your father's very concerned about your future, son, and you know, you really might want to reconsider what you're doing. And he's very, very concerned. And we're concerned. It's like, oh, fuck all y'all.
You know, it's hard. It's easy to say. It's hard to do. Carving your own path is a colossal. Speaking of pain in the ass, that is the biggest pain in the ass that there is. And no one is on board until finally other people approve. And then they come around and they're like, oh, you have a fan base and people are really interested in this. Okay. We like you now because
also,
others do.
It still seems a level of concern because ufology, we've talked about it sentencing on the show, it ruins lives.
It has not helped.
It really fucks with
you. Yeah.
James, I have a question about like what's going on right now. Obviously, we were talking about the soft disclosure that seems to be leaking out of the government.
We've been calling it a soft disclosure because we haven't yet seen. Because until Barack Obama is riding on a UFO on a saddle, I'm like, yeah! No one's going to really believe it.
That's a hard disclosure if you look at my crotch. Okay. What do you think of all of the information coming out now? Is this getting, you know, talking about, we were discussing Joe Rogan before, how Joe, because you were just recently on his show, he was a massive skeptic and now he is seems to be going all in when it comes to belief in UFOs. And we've sort of as a society come, I mean, the fact that Harry Reid even admitted, he's like, we got $20 million that we spent on UFO research. All of these things are coming to light. What do you feel as someone who's been studying this subject for so long? Do you think this is a psyop, as many people think, or do you think this is something where we're getting some legitimate truth for the first time?
Everything changed in December of 2017. The front page of the New York Times, whether you like the New York Times or not, that's a stamp of legitimacy on a secret Pentagon program that the likes of which has never happened in the past. I know this because I've received a lot of shit for decades from people all over. And even my next door neighbor is a mainstream editor, his name is Walter Murch Sr. He works with Coppola and Lucas. He did Apocalypse Now. He's a really, really famous editor.
Speaking of being in the fetal position crying, I can't imagine what editing Apocalypse Now must have done to the... It must have been worse than being in the war.
Oh, my God. I know. Anyway, and people like him came up to me, and they kind of cracked their jokes over the decades, you know, because we're neighbors. And he goes... He's kind of looking at his feet. This is right in December, probably December or January, you know, right after that New York Times story broke. He kind of looked at his feet. I was talking with the son in the kitchen. He goes, "Boy, James, you might have been right after all these years."
How did that make you feel? Did that make you angry, or does that make you feel validated? Because I could see both. Being like,
disclosure,
I know what I saw. Yes,
disclosure
I have been
is making like, some nerds really, really upset. Like, it is very, it's a hard for people, especially old, like, and Tom DeLonge being in the mix. Anybody with a lip ring that has that many women attracted to him never should be this important to ufology.
This guy being like, "Oh, I think you were right after all these years," is inferring that before he thought you were a total jackass.
I wasn't about to spike the ball in the end zone or anything, but it definitely was a nice feeling that the subject matter is being taken more seriously among high profile house recognized names like Harry Reid and like Bill Richardson and Podesta and all the other politicians that got involved, but also high level military guys. I mean, look at former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, Christopher Mellon, Lou Elizondo coming out. And look, the level of due diligence that the New York Times did, I know some people were disappointed with, like, they didn't go far enough, but I know the writers to that story. They told me behind the scenes what it took to get that published. They wanted to cross-check everything, documentation of the existence of the program, the verification that those videos were legitimate. I mean, they really did their work on that. And things changed. And here's another thing I'll say that I've noticed. Behind the scenes in the past, I've had people very interested in the film. I went and handed out copies of Out of the Blue to all members of the House and Senate. It took me like weeks. And I would have, you know, some congressmen, some staff members would quietly go, "God, we're so fascinated by this topic. This is amazing. You know, can't wait to watch your movie." But publicly, they were a lot less likely to do it. In fact, they were not likely at all to do it. And that's what I've seen with the phenomenon, is that the willingness to publicly endorse a film that also deals with close encounters, allegedly, of the third kind. In other words, witnesses describing beings associated to the craft. I've never done a film that covers that angle of the phenomenon before. That's a risky, slippery slope. And I was concerned that people like Harry Reid would say, "Whoa, you didn't tell me you're going to have little alien beings communicating telepathically with a bunch of kids in Africa. That's a little bit, you know."
Right. It's one of the most, to me, that's one of the most fascinating stories in ufology. I love that story of that group sightings.
Yeah.
I think are incredibly important, like the Coronado event, the Phoenix Lights, this idea that there are many people watching and you can't just say it's the figment of one person's imagination. Of course, now they say it's like group hallucination, like the idea that many people see like a phenomenon. But the, you know, with the Phoenix Lights, that was like, there's enough shit there. There's enough real, like how often are you going to tell these people their eyeballs are wrong?
I looked into that case for over 10 years. The Phoenix Lights case, 1997, the massive flyover. You talk to witnesses, they go, "Don't call it the Phoenix Lights." It was the massive flyover, crap flyover. This object was over a mile across from wingtip to wingtip, shaped like a boomerang. I literally talked to people on multiple occasions that pulled their car over to the side of the road on Interstate 10, got out of the car, and watched this massive, massive boomerang-shaped craft just float down the road.
So trippy.
People were standing outside of their cars on both sides of the freeway just going...
It's incredible.
Yeah, mouths wide open, staring up in the sky, yeah.
The governor of the governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, said that he's like, "I'm a pilot, a chief, you know, I was in the Air Force." He goes, "I took one look at that thing and I knew right away it wasn't from this world."
So, and of course, Fife, you know, we often joke about it, he brought the alien out, and you know, and it was a big lark. But now, you know, you're talking about people like Harry Reid. being able to accept that and being able to talk about that, it really is amazing how much things have changed over, you know, the past 20 years.
The past 3 or 4 years, yeah, things have changed. I mean, significantly, Fife Simonton publicly endorsed this movie.
Wow. Yeah. He had to come out, because he was embarrassed by his actions.
Yeah, he screwed up. Do you want to know how I got him to come forward? I don't know if you guys would want to hear
this. Please, of course.
Okay, so he agreed to an interview, which I remember my old partner at the time, he's like, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell to get Fife Simonton on camera. I'm all up. Oh, good enough for me. And I get a response from his office, and I get it pretty quickly. It's like, yeah, Fife will be willing to meet with you. So I call my buddy. I'm like, Fife's going to meet. He's going to meet with us. He's going to meet with us. He's like, well, what's he going to say? I'm like, who gives a fuck? Let's go. Got our camera gear together. And he said he'd meet with me in Santa Barbara. Well, on the way down to Santa Barbara, driving with all of our gear, I had this idea. I thought, well, wait a minute. Who better to present some of these questions to Fife other than some of his former constituents and people that actually voted for him?
That's awesome.
And witnesses. So I pulled the car over the side of the road, got my pocket tape recorder. I called this one woman, Stacy Rhodes. I called a couple other people, Mike Fortson, who's no longer with us. But I called Stacy Rhodes and I told her what I was doing. I said, hey, would you like to say anything to Fife Simonton? She's like, goddamn straight, I'd like to say something to him. So I said, okay, well, let me record a message. And I did. Well, when I first sat down with Fife, I just kind of, you know, I wanted to get what I was going to get out of him before I, you know, ambushed him with this pretty aggressive, angry woman. I mean, she was angry. So we do the interview for about a half an hour, 45 minutes, kind of things start lighting up. And I said, hey, and nothing had come out yet. I mean, things had come out, but he didn't make the big reveal yet. I said, hey, Governor, if you don't mind, I actually have one of your former constituents and also a witness to the event, this woman, Stacy, and she had a couple questions for you. And I recorded them, you know, earlier today on my pocket tape recorder. And he gets a little uncomfortable. He's like, oh, it's been a while since I've been kind of caught off guard or something. And I said, all right, so, you know, hit play. And she's like, do you still think it's a joke? All of us, you know, people across the state of Arizona, we all saw this thing. And, you know, these people saw it and thousands of people saw it. And we just wanted answers. And then you went and made a big joke with your buddy dressed in an alien suit. Do you really still think it's funny 10 years later? Like, really lays into him. And I can see him kind of squirming in his chair. And I pressed stop and I was like, okay, well, let's see what happens now. I mean, he could just get up and leave. And he sat there, and I could see the gears turning. He sat there, and he was like, fuck it. I saw that thing, too. And wow. I could tell.
Talking about.
And let me tell you, it's only been a couple of moments in my several decades-long pursuit of truth on this whole topic where I was sitting down with someone, and I was in such a state of disbelief that I literally, and I'm not just – I literally reached out. I had to pinch my leg because I was like, that didn't just happen. There's just no way he said what I thought he said. I'm probably dreaming. So I was quietly and discreetly pinching my skin on my right leg. I swear to God. And then I went, okay, well, I'm not dreaming. I bet you the camera stopped rolling. And I looked over at the camera.
Something had to go wrong.
Yeah, this didn't just happen. I'm looking at the camera. I'm like, there's the red light. It's flashing. Okay, this is good. There's the tape. Yeah.
That's great.
And that was it. Yeah.
Wow. My question is, now that you've been doing this a bunch of years and you talk to the, now you see this, like you're watching like these walls crumble down, like in terms of people being able to finally come out and talk about this. Where are you on the spectrum of belief, right? Because like we spoke with Stanton Friedman right before he passed, and he basically said that he's one of the mind that he is, you know, nuts and bolts. These are just crafts that come from another galaxy, and we need to scientifically understand them as this a biological / like geographical event. These are ships that arrive here. And then someone like when you appeared with Rogan with my hero, the best hair in ufology, Jacques Vallée, he came out in his belief that it's a psychic control system and that these, whatever the phenomena seems to also kind of come from us. Where are you at now kind of hearing all of these
pretty
stories,
opposite ideas? Yeah.
Yeah. Like where one is essentially space leprechauns, which I personally believe in truly. And then the idea of like tourists coming to see us or researchers from another galaxy coming to look at us. Like where, or does the years of working on this make it just that much more gray?
And if you want to talk about football or anything halfway through, feel free.
Well, I've studied the 1964 Socorro UFO incident extensively. I could say that I've spent the better part of 5 years on that case. It was involved a police officer. It's the first extremely well-documented close encounter of the third kind in U.S. history. Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy story, and it's also really well documented. It's probably the most compelling close encounter of the third kind in U.S. history, and it involved a police officer by the name of Lonnie Zamora. And the reason why I address this is because the credibility level of the witness, police officer. There were other people in the town that saw the UFO but didn't see the beings. The object left marks on the ground, even potentially some metal shavings from the landing gear and a broken rock. It was heavy. They could guesstimate the weight of it just because of the compressions in the soil and the diameter of the landing gear. And then there were footprints corresponding exactly in the location that Lonnie, the police officer, claimed to have seen these beans, which were all diagrams were made by the first military officer on the scene. So you've got an incident that left physical trace case evidence on the ground. There were burn marks. There were vegetation was smoldering when this object, you know, was just after it left.
Yeah.
And so that would be an indication that we're dealing with a nuts and bolts phenomenon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got other cases where you get instances where you can make the argument that it's not a nuts and bolts. So I kind of tend to lean in the direction of we might be dealing with all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't hang my hat on that theory, but I probably, there's two things I feel pretty comfortable saying. And I've talked to people very high up about this, conclusion wise. One is it's a global phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an omnipresent intelligence that has the ability to manifest itself in a multitude of ways. What I said earlier about the nuts and bolts aspect, but there's also a psychic aspect. And there are witnesses that claim, you know, the object will suddenly disappear out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't fly right into scene or it blinks out of nowhere. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, people often ask me, like, why the secrecy, you know? And I want to know, too. I'm a civilian, guys. I mean, I'm just, I'm you guys. I just happen to be someone that was concerned enough and curious enough to, you know, look into this. And I keep saying, every time I finish one movie, I say, boy, my God, I got that over with. I'm never doing another one of those again. You know,
Now it's time for my rom-com.
Yeah. Now what I've learned is never say never. So, is that the secrecy, the government secrecy, is much more of a question of what the government doesn't know than what they do know.
Like, they just don't know.
So look, you could, like, and that even plays into Roswell. I believe Roswell happened as the 509th in 1947 when they made the announcement they recovered a flying saucer. I believe that's what really happened. You've got the very people that were involved in making that initial announcement. You've got the people that were involved right afterwards within a 24-hour period saying that they covered it up and they threw some debris from a weather balloon down. And then you got them later in life going on camera saying that was a lie. It was the initial statement that we put out was the accurate statement.
Right.
And, but even if you take that assumption, so we recovered some bodies and we recovered some debris, okay? It still doesn't mean you have the answers of, like, where they come from, why they're here.
The most, like, quote-unquote legit explanation, right, came from that book, I believe Area 51, or was it Roswell, where they said that it was a downed Russian craft where they took mentally handicapped people and surgically altered...
Absolute bullshit. Okay, forget about it. Don't waste any time thinking about that. But in any case, even if, you know, we have the hardware, and I'm pretty convinced that we do, and we have recovered bodies, in which I'm pretty convinced that we have done that as well, it still doesn't mean we have answers. And so let's just say that those in the know disclose what they know. You know, yeah, these things are real. They fly rings around our fastest jets. The technology, the observed technology, is light years advanced from anything we have. They fly rings around our fastest jets. They go into these super sensitive nuclear weapons facilities to shut our weapons off. In a couple of instances, they turn them on.
I'd prefer if they didn't do that. Yeah.
But we know that they really are hinting, because that seems to be the next level of whatever the bit of a harder side of disclosure is, that it does seem to be. There's a little bit of a dalliance saying we might have something in a hangar, but yeah, it seems like if they can't figure out how to get weapons technology out of it, it might not even be worth a significant amount of money to the U.S. government for them to figure out. Like, they have this thing, they can't figure out what to do with it. They can't figure out how it goes from water to air with no resistance, because that seems to be like the thing that they want to know. Like how can it do transverse mediums, all this kind of bullshit. But it seems like they might have something, but maybe that's what it is. The reason why we have not gotten a full, like, here, this is what this is because they haven't either milked it for the technology they can get out of it, or legitimately it has become just a hunk of space metal that they can't do anything with.
It's also left the hands. It's no longer, I believe, and I've been told this by some pretty high level people, it's no longer in the hands of government. It's in the private sector. So when they say it's free of oversight, they're actually telling the truth. And that, a genius way of dealing with it, quite honestly.
But I do want to ask, like, why? Like, we were talking about, like, Fife Symington and all this stuff, where they're like, yeah, you know, I saw it too, all this stuff. But why do you think they're doing this now? Or what, I guess more of the question is, what were they trying to avoid by telling people it's a weather balloon, it's not real, it's a lark? What were they trying, what were they so worried about? And as of 2017, that the population was going to, were they concerned that people were going to freak out, religion was going to be lost, there was going to be chaos? Because there's a lot of people who also think this could really bring folks together.
Well, if you look back historically, since the modern UFO wave in the 40s, there were military and government officials that wanted this story out. And I think it culminated in 1952 when the White House and the Capitol building were buzzed, that famous two consecutive weekends of July of 1952. And there was a press conference that dealt with General John Sanford, a general, Air Force general in uniform, that addressed the nation about it. And he says some pretty startling things. We feature a few excerpts in the phenomenon, but a lot of people know about this, but it was a very, it pretty much admitted that, you know, we're dealing with something that wasn't ours. And it was witnessed by incredible people of really incredible things. I mean, it was a pretty powerful statement. And then you had the head of Project Blue Book at the time, Ruppelt, who wrote a book about UFOs, very pro-UFOs. Some people say he pivoted after that. But there's been this internal struggle that has been going on since the modern UFO wave, where you've had people that wanted to disclose and be honest with and have full transparency with the American public. But I think there was also a more pragmatic group of people that were like, look, you know, maybe we should suspend any type of disclosure and assess what's going on and be able to provide more accurate, you know, answers. Because look, once you open up the floodgates, once you disclose what you know, it also exposes all these things that you don't know and your vulnerabilities. So I think legitimately at the time they decided, hey, let's regroup on this. Let's put some energy into this, into studying this phenomenon and see what we can come up with.
Oh my God. They did the boardroom. Let's circle back. We'll circle back in 30 years.
Well, they also had that meeting right after the two consecutive weekends in 1952 over the Capitol building where they scrambled jets. They intercepted these UFOs. I mean, it's an incredible story. And then shortly thereafter, I think it was January of 1953, they convened that intellectual heavyweight scientific panel, commonly referred to as the Robertson panel. And that was like, the Air Force was like, well, what do we do? How do we deal with this problem? Because for them, it was a problem. You have unidentified objects penetrating sensitive airspace, particularly flying over the White House and the Capitol building, and there's nothing we can do to stop it. So to the Air Force, it was a problem. And this panel basically told the, you know, like, hey, our recommendation is you can't really stop it, but you can't ridicule those who claim to have seen them. And so that policy stuck in 1953 and was a very effective campaign of ridicule. That kind of stuck, and I think it kind of went underground. And then, you know, I remember even, this is fascinating, this is something that I regretted not having brought up on Rogan, because Jacques Vallée met with Quintanilla. Quintanilla was head of Project Blue Book at a very critical time. And Jacques pulled Quintanilla aside, and he was like, you know, hey, why don't you guys kind of, he's like, look, you know, it's not our job at the Air Force for the, you know, the philosophical implications of, you know, are we alone or are we not? It's not our job. Our job is to protect you guys and secure our airspace. That's what our job is. Right. And he had that really like pragmatic response to Jacques Vallée. And I wanted to get it, you know, to Rogan, but basically what he was saying was like, look, you know, it's not our job to study this stuff. It's not our job to determine whether we're learning the universe. It's our job to secure our airspace. And right. So it was, to them, it was a problem. They didn't want to deal with it. They got rid of the problem in 69, and it just went underground at that point.
Yeah, because if it's not blowing our shit up, essentially, like if it's not coming in and hitting us with weapons, then what else can we do? It seems to just be hyper curious, almost, it almost does impressions of our military. That's how it was when we covered the Rendlesham Forest incident. We were talking about this concept of like, sometimes it feels like this phenomena, to use the title of the documentary, will sometimes literally just do impressions of our planes. Like they are like copying us. Like they are kind of almost in a weird way, like trying to be like, hi, we see what you do.
Well, and I do want to point out to the audience that we did scoop Joe Rogan there. And I think that's a really powerful thing. That Joe Rogan did not get that information, and we got it right here on last podcast on the left. We are speaking with James Fox, the director of the new documentary, The Phenomenon. Cannot recommend it enough. Please go out there. What else do you got to do?
So
sit on your tuchus and enjoy a documentary.
It's honestly one of the best UFO documentaries I've seen in years. I'm very excited. You know what to do.
You know what to do.
You know what to do. Sarah Scholes wrote a book called They Already Here. It also talked a little bit about some of the hesitancy of the military to talk about aliens, because she actually, I thought, brought up a really good point, is that there's also an evangelical streak in the military, and they view UFOs and aliens as demonic.
Yeah, Harry Reid told me that.
Really? I thought that was fascinating.
Harry Reid told me that. I said, hey, Harry Reid was like, yeah, we had a certain level of, he had a very significant pushback with the intelligence agencies back in 2007 when he was trying to get this project off the ground. I mean, he said the pushback was significant. And then he said when he started getting some of their conclusions and some of the evidence that was coming out, these things are going in and out of the water, or these things are picked up by cockpit recording from the fighter jets. He was like, yeah, these... Literally, he had senators and congressmen that said, you know, that's demonic. We don't want to even look at it. We don't talk about it.
I mean, honestly, if they did look like straight up like South Park, like demons, like little devils in there, it would be kind of cool.
Yeah, they got like force. They got like, but you know, the grays look weird. And then also this is what leads into sort of my next question, this idea of there being many of these types of entities. And now the news that we covered this week was this weird ass interview that Haim Eshad, the former space minister, the minister of space travel, basically the head of the Israeli version of NASA, basically came out and said that, yes, the U.S. government has an active treaty, U.S. and Israel, they work with various races of the extraterrestrials, and that we know them physically, that Eisenhower actually did go and meet with Greys and made an arrangement that a certain amount of American bodies were allowed to be experimented on in exchange for technology. Like this very esoteric weird realm of ufology. And I wonder what's your take on that, like the secret space program, this idea that, like, you know, Project Serpo, like this idea that there is a whole other, like the black budgets of the intelligence community are essentially working on a secret space program, and there's a base on the other side of the moon, and we speak with grays, and that Donald Trump, he was scared, he was made scared by the aliens, so he wouldn't tell anybody about it.
So disinformation is a very effective campaign to basically muddy the waters to the point where the legitimate scientific community wants nothing to do with this topic. And mm-hmm. I think it's been a very credible effort. And I have to say, in response to the recent story of this guy, no matter what his rank and level of credibility, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Yes.
And if you can't present that, and every time I do a documentary, I'm not kidding you, I literally think of myself in a court of law presenting my case to a jury. Okay. And if I can't convince that jury, I'm not out there peddling, you know, crazy conspiracy theories. I have substance behind all the statements that I make, and I have substance and testimony and documentation. I could back it up at a court of law 7 days a week. There are so many aspects of the phenomenon that are told from all kinds of different people. And my thing is, back it up with evidence. Don't just talk about it.
But no, but you have to understand, Mr. Fox, the evidence is in his new book, which is coming out very, very soon.
Yeah, I know. When I was investigating Socorro, New Mexico landing site, now keep your audience in mind that that's a close encounter of a third kind, but it's a very credible case. And if you look at the testimony, you look at the government documents, you look at the diagrams that were done on the landing site, and you speak to his family, it's a very, very solid case, okay? Now, I uncovered at the time, inadvertently, while I was investigating the Socorro landing case, a stone's throw by air, I don't know, maybe it's under 100 miles away. You've got Holloman Air Force Base, White Sands Testing Range. I came across some articles from Corral Lorenzen. The relevance of the story will hit you in a second here. It'll make sense. I came across, she's a very credible researcher. She had, I think it was called UFO Bulletin in the 50s and 60s. And it was a couple of articles about military men that were stationed at Holloman Air Force Base that claimed a landing that was filmed on camera. Now, keep in mind, it sounds outlandish, that I believe that Socorro landing took place and that the occupants got out. Okay, and that they were witnessed by a police officer. I believe that. So you take right around the same period, and you take that case at Holloman Air Force Base, White Sands, and you say, all right, well, just maybe a landing did take place there. Maybe by chance the military had their cameras rolling. Okay, maybe. But I heard about this Holloman Air Force Base landing case, and it's pretty credible.
This is like a crazy video, right? Because they say that there's video of these aliens coming out, and they have big noses.
Yes.
It's very strange. Yes.
Yeah. So I know this sounds crazy, but I started to look into it a little bit, and there's a film called UFOs Past, Present, or Future by Alan Sandler and Bob Emanator. So I got to know both of them. I interviewed them. They were working on the film in the 70s, and they had unprecedented access to military bases through a gentleman named Colonel William T. Coleman, who was public spokesman for the Pentagon, and earlier than that for Project Blue Book, a very well-connected, very well-positioned guy. And I interviewed him. I interviewed Bob Emanator, who made the movie. And in the movie, they talked about this incident, this alleged landing incident that was filmed on camera and the beans getting out. Now, I know it sounds nuts. I really do. But there's enough credible testimony as to the existence of that film footage. I actually spoke to Alan Sandler, who's seen it with his own eyes. It was shown to him by a guy named Paul Schartle, who was operating the audiovisual department at Norton Air Force Base at the time. So I know the film footage, and he felt it existed. It was something else. Alan Sandler saw it. I talked to him directly about it, and Bob Emanator knew all about it, okay? So I think that case happened. Now, this is the twist. So if you start to look into that, I could probably dig up and make a whole movie on it. I probably could. But what happened was they suddenly expanded on that story, extrapolated. All this disinformation started coming out about Eisenhower met at the base with aliens, and they did a treaty, and they did all this stuff. So if you start going down that rabbit hole, you know, you go, oh, Jesus, like, what? But treaties, meetings with aliens and the president.
Some people do. I just got rock hard.
Yeah, I know. So, well, so what I'm saying is I'm pretty well convinced, based on my personal research into that landing case at Holloman, right around the same time of the Socorro, New Mexico case. What I am not convinced is there was all the disinformation about meetings with the president at the alien base. I think it was deliberately done to throw people off the trail of that footage.
Wow. So I guess my question is, as sort of someone who is really loving learning about this subject, how do you, what are red flags? When should I put my red flags up, or when people are talking? Because we had Hellyer, the Canadian defense minister. He's talking about similar things with treaties and things like that.
Meeting aliens.
What should we look for when hearing these stories for, like, that sounds like disinfo and this sounds like true? Because I guess that's why it's such a hard subject. Because, well, like, there's so many lies, and there's so many truths. And
they're both fucking 90 years old. So my mind is that, while, yeah, if they are saying, I'm finally old enough to tell the story and people ridicule me, but it's almost the others. Then I start thinking about being like, aren't you also too old to be doing disinformation? Why don't you just go to sleep? Why don't you just read the newspaper?
Okay, so I have to keep reminding you guys, your audience, is that, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And with people like Paul Hellyer, seems like a really nice guy. But remember, he had no official experience researching UFOs at his time.
I believe he was the defense minister, I believe.
Yeah, so but no official experience with the phenomenon. Zero. Mm-hmm. It was all after he left. Okay. So yeah, he's got a pretty title. And it sounds amazing, but when you look into it, it's like, oh, so he read some books on people making all these outrageous, outlandish claims. It's like, well, can you prove that in a court of law? Like, can you show me some evidence? Yeah, well, personally, I don't talk about things publicly that I can't back up. And there are a lot of people that do.
I get into the world of disinformation spinning out to the point where I can imagine, you know, we did this whole series on JFK this year, and just despite even thinking about him being murdered by the CIA, it's not even about that. It's just knowing how far they're willing to go versus what they actually will do. Sometimes makes me think, I can almost see a world where, we talked about this last episode, where you could, an intelligence officer, to create disinformation, literally dresses somebody up as a fucking alien and, like, moves them into a meeting with Paul Hellyer and be like, this guy's an alien, you know, and he's just like, whoa, like, he's, like, totally fooled. Like,
basically, are these people also victims of disinformation themselves?
Well, they might very well be. And look, I've had conversations about, like, how do I feel about Bob Lazar, for instance?
That's a weird case. Yeah. That's a weird case.
I've met Bob Lazar, and I've talked to people about it. I don't generally speak about it publicly because I don't know, I haven't researched enough to speak intelligently on this. I'm not educated on all the facts. But my initial response was, hey, the guy believes what he's saying. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that he wasn't used as a tool of disinformation to muddy the waters? Maybe it's half-truths. Some things that he says are true and other things are not true. That's certainly possible. He doesn't come across to me, and just to me, having met him, he doesn't come across as someone who believes that he's lying.
But that's a lot of pre-pro for disinformation. You know what I mean? Where it's like, why are they putting so much effort into just decide? Like, let's say it is all disinformation. Why? Like, I wonder what it is. Is it just to kind of, like, it's just us warring with other countries for everybody's brains, or trying to hide technology that we have, or try to overstate the technology that we have?
Well, in terms of the technology, and this, I remember Stanton Friedman actually saying this to me. He goes, James, remember, you can't share the technology with your friends without sharing it with your enemies. So the military looks at the upper hand, like, oh, wow, they've got this potentially revolutionary you know, technology, God, think about all the weapons we could make with this stuff. We could dominate the world, you know? Mm-hmm. So for them, it's not like, hey, the psychological and philosophical implications of the fact that we're not alone in the universe is amazing. It's like, no, what can we do to rule the world and control everybody? You know, it's just how they think, you know?
Yeah. And the ultimate porn bots, like the ultimate VR porn bots, like Eddie being able to do all these incredible things. Yeah. They don't care about philosophy. They just want to turn it into a gun.
We literally are living in the world. It's basically Pinky and the Brain. And we're Pinky, and they're the Brain. And they're very malicious in their own way.
But also, Mr. Fox, tell me, so how much do you get paid by the CIA to be a shill? How is that going?
You know, cash drops. Briefcase cash drops. Yeah, you know.
That documentary lifestyle. If you want money, get into documentary.
It's a Rosa Ferrari. I know. Yeah. There were periods where I was so broke I could barely afford to pay attention. I remember, like, I'm not kidding you. I remember walking out into the night sky and looking up at the heavens. I'm not particularly a religious guy, but I was like, okay, God, if you're listening, I could really use your help right about now.
Yeah, I could go for some money right now if you are there, God.
I think they really overstate how much money's made in ufology. I think that's the one thing I say when every single time these witnesses come out, that's my, like, especially people that believe that they have experienced being abducted, like, it's really intense. Like, how do you tell these people? Obviously, seem to be. I narrated a documentary about the supposed hybrid program, right? Like this idea that grays are like, it's a very far flung topic about how grays supposedly are using humans.
Robert Jenkins.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, but to use this, to create human gray babies that can live in our dimensional circumstances, whatever it is they want to do it. But the people that talk about these circumstances, it is akin to sexual assault. Like, they are being raped by these aliens and they feel that they are. And you can't take that truth from them. Something's happening in the middle of it. And they are not making good cash. Most of the time, it ruins their lives.
Yeah, one of my financial backers, He doesn't talk about it publicly, but he has pulled me aside on a handful of times and he's said that he's an experiencer like that. Mm-hmm. And he's not trying to sell his story. He's not trying to be in a documentary. He's not trying to go public. He, you know, and it's cases like those that, that really, make you wonder, about that whole aspect of the phenomenon. And it's something that, you know, I haven't delved into yet publicly because of my fear that I would be going down a rabbit hole and that there really isn't a lot of tangible evidence to support those claims, and it just gets lost in the woods a little bit. But that's not to say that I don't find some of those accounts incredibly fascinating and compelling. Yeah.
I guess that goes to the question that I wanted to talk about earlier as well regarding intent and what the intent is of these, whatever we're going to agree, whatever they are, whether, you know, nuts and bolts or more of a psychological type thing. But we had Stephen Greer. I watched a documentary that The Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. And Henry and I totally disagree because Henry's a war hawk.
I'm just saying he's the
Donald Rumsfeld of ufology.
We should just not necessarily be attempting to invite them to lunch.
The physicist,
Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking, that's what he said. He's like, be careful what you ask for. It might not end well.
Because truly, if they're like us, they're going to be like, oh, look at all those little pink monkeys. Yeah. I can't wait to turn them into food or workers. And we're not going to be good workers. We like our independence nowadays.
We've gotten too soft as a people. We're definitely we're food now. Now we're just nothing but chicken poppers to them. But what do you think, and what is your perspective, James Fox, again, the director of The Phenomenon, check out that documentary. What are your thoughts as far as the intent of whatever these extraterrestrials are?
If they were here to destroy us, it would have happened. I mean, it's just, there's no question that, in my opinion, they're not here to destroy us. I mean, all the witnesses I've talked to, both military, civilian, that's just not the case. And again, this is just my view, but it's informed speculation. I don't know.
We're unknown. It's unknowable.
You know, it's funny, actually. Let me tell you a quick story that left an indelible impression on me. And I think about it all the time. And that is, there was a very famous UFO encounter that happened over Tehran, Iran, in 1976. And it involved a gentleman who was a general in the Iranian army or military named Parviz Jafari. And I went to great lengths to get him to come out to the 2007 National Press Club event that was taking place in Washington, D.C., that I did it with Leslie Kane, and I made the movie about with called I Know What I Saw.
Yeah. Awesome.
And I remember I was going down the Grand Canyon in wooden dories about 4 weeks prior to the event. And the negotiations at the time, just a year earlier, George W. Bush had called Iran an enemy of the state. And so the process of getting a visa to come to the United States was a bloody nightmare. And I remember Leslie called me up and she goes, because I said to Leslie, I was like, hey, man, I'm going to be off the radar. I'm going down the Grand Canyon for the better part of 2 weeks. She goes, look, man, we got this predicament going on right now. This is going to be a very expensive process. We got Parviz Jafari. He wants to come to the United States, but he has to go to Dubai twice, and you got to fly him to Dubai for the process of trying to get a visa. And it's probably going to cost, you know, I don't know, to throw a number. I think it was like $10,000 or $12,000 just to see if he can go to the United States. So it was a big gamble. It was a big gamble. And I remember on the phone in a cafe, and I was just about to drive to the Grand Canyon to go down in these wooden dories. I was doing a little film on a conservationist that helped save the Grand Canyon from all these proposed dams in the 50s. And I remember having to make that decision on the fly. And I said, Leslie, fuck it. Go for it. Let's do this. Let's take a gamble. And it was and I hung the phone up and I thought, oh God, I hope he gets his visa. Jesus.
He better.
And, you know, and it was a huge chunk of money. And anyway, I came back out of the Grand Canyon after being completely isolated from the world for a couple of weeks. And she calls me up. She's like, he made it. He's coming. I was like, ah, great. So I met with this guy and he had time to reflect back on this incredibly dramatic encounter he had with the UFO where he tried to shoot at it. Like he got it in its sights and he was engaging to shoot it. And just as he was pulling his fingers down to pull the trigger, all of his controls froze up and he literally started spiraling out of the sky and he was going, shit, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. And he was contemplating having to eject. He goes, if I got to a certain altitude, I was going to have to eject out of this thing. It was the middle of the night. And so he said to me during the interview, and this was something that I included in the phenomenon, but not in I Know What I Saw, because I different mindset today. I was looking for different things. He said, you know, James, one of my biggest regrets was that why didn't I try to make friendly contact? Why did I try to kill it? And he goes, I wish if I could do it over again, I would have gotten on the radio and tried to talk to it and not engage it in war. And I just thought, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, well, that's allegory.
And that's kind of the inverse of the question too. Like, do they come in peace? It's like, are we peaceful enough for them to come in peace?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, it took me like an hour to get to that story, but I wanted you to know what it took to get that guy, you know.
No, this is very important because I think that there are UFO documentaries that are way more like PowerPoint presentations. You got the Matrix, you know, which pill are you going to take? They always do that cut scene in the very beginning where they, you know, you always have to have like, you know, but there's something about, that's why I like your documentary so much is that there is so much effort put in and that you can really see how much due diligence you're doing to tell a responsible story about this subject because it's just filled with fucking landmines.
One of the things I've been told by some of the people I'm working with now that are involved with the distribution and marketing and all that stuff. I said, James, don't read the reviews. Just trust me. Don't do it. But sometimes you can't help yourself. You know, you want
to it's awful. My wife called it cutting. She says, are you cutting?
Yeah. Oh yeah. So the other day I found myself, I was going down that rabbit hole. It's like, oh boy. And there were a couple of people that were like, you know, clearly seasoned people down the, you know, into the whole phenomenon. They're like, there's nothing new here and the same old rehashed bullshit history and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, well, first of all, if this guy, if this person had any idea what I went through to uncover never before seen archival footage, I spent 3 years in the trenches just going after archival, never before seen UFO footage. I can't change history. Look, if I'm going to cover the last 75 years of the most poignant, salient UFO cases or incidences, then I can't change it. But right. I can add new testimony, never before seen footage, which I tried to do. Case in point, you know, Kenneth Arnold. We all know about the Kenneth Arnold 1947. Yes. It's when coined the phrase flying saucers. Everybody knows that case. If I told you what it took to get Kenneth's daughter, Kim Arnold, on camera, your eyes would glaze over, okay, and how long it right. took. And it was the most difficult interview I've ever had to pin down. It was 100 times more difficult than getting Harry Reid on camera.
Harry Reid likes to be you, man.
You know, that was tricky too, but yeah.
It's always, people don't understand that we actually we've had some amazing guests such as yourself, Mr. Fox. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
But some of the most difficult people, we were trying to get BTK's daughter and you would have thought she was Elvis. Like, it was impossible. And it's like, you're BTK's daughter. Like, but how is this so hard to get you to talk?
Yeah. Let me just finish up on Kim Arnold really quickly. I'll let you know, just to get her and her daughter out to California from Idaho was a monumental task, okay? Trust me when I tell your audience this. She arrives. I'm thinking, my voice was gone because all the negotiations I've been doing, and I had to, like, convince my supporter, my financial backer at the time, Sky Larry, and he was like, this is a big waste of money. And it, you know, anyway, I got her to come to the shoot location. It's all happening. She arrives. She was going to reveal all these photographs and letters of correspondence with the Air Force and really cool stuff about a case that everyone knows, but aspects of the case that nobody knew about.
Yes.
I felt like it was really worth it. So she arrives at location. I meet her. It's raining. It's in Los Angeles. She's got a driver. She's got her daughter. She's like, well, I want my reimbursement. And before I go on camera, I want it right now. She's still in the car. So I said, okay, yeah. Larry. And Larry's standing there, just like, he could tell he didn't want it. He was already pissed off. So he hands her a check, and she goes, what's this? And he goes, it's a check. She goes, I'm not taking this. He's like, look, lady, I've just about had it with you. And she's like, you know what? Fuck you. He goes, you know what? Fuck you.
And she goes, no.
I swear to God, driver, take me to the airport. I went, oh, wait a minute. Larry, stop. Wait, driver, don't move. Hang on. And then her daughter's like, honey, mom, you shut the hell up. Like,
oh, my God.
Jesus Christ. You learn how, like, she immediately learned how to negotiate. You're like, this is like Kim Jong-un level negotiation.
I literally, like, got all that action. And so that's why I laughed. She's only in there for, what, I don't know, 30 seconds?
Yeah, it's like one good blurb. Yeah, oh, and I was like, that's all I needed.
Your audience would, your eyes would glaze over, your ears would, you know, if I told you, like, but it was
Lord.
I have a story like that behind every single interview I've done. I'm not kidding you. Like, what it took to bring people together was just, oh my God.
It's true. Wait, before we get out of here, Mr. Fox, who's got the good shit? Like, this is my question in terms of footage. I know that there's good footage because you see it in docs all the time, and I scour the internet looking for footage. And my question is how do I get that good, that solid? I know there's very little solid UFO footage to begin with that's really, really good, that's not like Billy Meyer level, like human Photoshop. But where's the good shit?
One thing that I've learned is that if you have the good shit, don't be talking about it publicly. Don't talk about it on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Make many copies of it. Again, your audience's eyes would glaze over if I could sit there and tell you how many cases that I've heard of good stuff disappearing, photographs, video, film, bits of metal. Like, even Jacques Vallée, when I was in the laboratory in Silicon Valley with Gary Nolan doing that segment of the movie, I'm not kidding you, Jacques was walking around with his metal samples like this.
I bet.
Yeah, holding them like a baby. Yeah.
And I said, Jacques, he goes, these things have a very strange way of disappearing like this. And I said, yeah, I've heard those stories myself. And one of the if you are in possession of good material, And I mean legitimate material, not just the real deal stuff.
Yeah.
And there's only a handful of that stuff out there that I've seen, one of which has never seen the light of day. The chances are you will get a visit. I know it sounds crazy, and I don't expect your audience to believe me, but I could tell you story after story until the sun comes up, okay, about how many times people have had tangible evidence disappear. It probably took me 10 years before I realized, all right, this really does happen.
Well, what is that experience like? What is that?
There's a very well-known Stanford physicist that had warned me about 5 years ago when he passed off some materials to me. And he said, meet me for lunch at a restaurant. So, oh God, it's going to be really great to see you. And I'd like to bring my partner, Rebecca. Oh, no, just want you to come, just you. And anyway, I meet with him. This is a really respected physicist. If I said his name, people would, he's up to on par with Jacques Vallée. He said, make me one promise. I said, what's that? He said, promise me you'll never talk publicly about this. You'll never text about it. You'll never email about it. And I said, Jesus, you're really paranoid. He said, yeah, with good reason. And I said, well, give me why? He's like, 3 out of the 6 samples that I had vanished. And the last time it happened, my bank vault was emptied and they left the door open to the vault. And the bank manager called him up and said, this is totally inexplicable, but your bank vault door is open and there's nothing inside.
Oh my
and
God.
Maybe that was a little way for them saying that you can't hide this stuff. But I know this sounds crazy and you guys don't have to believe me, but if anybody out there ever gets good evidence, don't talk about it on social media. Don't email about it. Make copies, put them on all sorts of different locations, and then you can approach a media outlet and do it publicly that way. Otherwise, I promise you, with 99% certainty, this stuff will disappear.
So you think is hiding in plain sight the way to go? So you do think it's good to like get journalists on board and get your name out there? You think that would be the safest way to approach it?
Yeah, I wasn't saying in terms of people getting killed. I just that their evidence will disappear. I could literally tell you stories until the sun came up. And it probably took me the better part of 10 years to make that realization. And it sounds paranoid and I sound crazy. I get it, but it's just the way it is.
Wow. And now we're waiting on this new picture. There's like new proof that's supposed to come out. The last picture turned out to, I guess, to be a balloon, but there's supposed to be this picture of a triangle UFO in daylight that I wonder if we will ever see.
I think there's a good chance that we'll see that.
God, I can't wait. God,
I've heard it's really good too.
My breasts are filled with milk.
I know. It was taken by a Navy officer. Oh, yeah. Let me say one last thing.
Of course.
This is really helpful to me, you guys. First of all, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on us.
Not for coming on us.
Yeah, taking the time and just giving me a feedback on Amazon or iTunes or Rotten Tomatoes, just take 1 minute little review. It actually is really helpful for me.
Absolutely.
That's very good to know. And rent the movie, right? Is the best way to get it through Prime?
Totally. You can get it through if you rent it, get it the cheapest plot. You can find it probably for $3.99. But if you buy it, you get it through iTunes or Vimeo. It comes with 3 hours of bonus material for the same price. But it's the only two platforms that offer it, because I gave it over when I put this movie up, but only two platforms offer it. Same price, iTunes, Vimeo, 3 hours of bonus material.
I will be doing that.
The Phenomenon, that is the name of the documentary, The Phenomenon. Well, I'm sure we'll put it in the link here as well or in the description of the episode. James Fox, thank you so much for coming on the show. And you have to come back because we didn't even get to what's going on with all of the new space exploration that's going on. We were talking about all the rocket launches that happen on a daily basis between public and private sectors. Just the amount of insanity, we can talk forever. And we just appreciate you so much. And please come back on the show. We really hope we can. I think we will get some new eyeballs on this documentary.
Yes.
2021 is going to be a good year.
Yes, it will be.
I think so. Yes, I really do think so. This is a year of learning. This is a year of growth. And then next year will be a year of irresponsibility.
I love it. You guys, thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, dude.
Live from your grave.
All right, there it was, our conversation with James Fox. That was really wonderful. Interesting. You have chills. I know. I just love that he is doing all of the due diligence and making it a real thing.
I mean it. He is legit in terms of what his documentaries versus, you know, I love all sorts of whatever. I watch any bullshit, obviously, and I love all of it. I like going into the really stupid realm. I like going into the really into like whatever is available. I watch, but he really makes compelling documentaries because he does exhaust as much material as he can, and he goes after cases and stories that he can like show there's a lot of evidence here. Like, it's really cool. It's really cool. Also, it's not very speculative.
I also love that it was good insight into the painful, horrific process of being a documentarian. For anyone out there that wants to be a documentarian, it requires having an editor in the fetal position crying. If that doesn't happen once during the documentary,
you're not making a real one.
You're not making a real
one. You're not Ken Burns.
The Ken Burns editing craft. The editors of the baseball documentary just openly weeping.
I think they all just died from fucking boredom.
Well, yeah, the baseball one didn't really give me too much. But anyway, James Fox, check out The Phenomenon. And if you haven't seen I Know What I Saw, it really is awesome.
It's
and
it's so
a perfect freaking title. It really, he nailed the title. It is a perfect freaking title.
Oh, yeah, dude. That's like every day I know what I saw.
Yeah. So thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. And we really appreciate you. Hope you're all hanging in there the best you can. And never forget, hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Magustalations, everybody.
Hail me.
Let's go find some goddamn aliens.
Thank you for your money.
Thank you so much.